Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I'm broke as ever, and I ask for my friend's assistance in keeping this show on the air, financing my research. I do not have a university, I don't have an organization, I don't have a think tank. It's just me. Me and you, that is. Last time, I gave a general outline of a few military leaders, military dictators of Latin America. As you know, it's a commonplace, even amongst conservatives, to say that the United States during the Cold War supported dictatorial and brutal regimes, which they assume are right-wing, that employed death squads, and they existed for no other reason than to stop the spontaneous rebellion of peasants and workers who have been treated unfairly, all for the sole purpose of boosting the profits of the local elite as well as American investors. None of that is true. As always, whenever you describe something in the white hat, black hat terms like that, you're usually wrong. Politics is far more complicated than that. As I said last week, the very first issue I ever took up as a young freshman in college was just this, that liberal democracy is a fraud. And there are so many different ways that I could attack it from. One of the reasons I became, you know, I have degrees in both, my doctorate degrees are in both philosophy and political science, which I think I thought was necessary at the time. So I had both sorts of professors on my committee. There's a million different ways I can attack it, but as a historian, I want to simply talk about how liberal democracy functions in real life, because normally, what happens is you talk about a dictator somewhere, no matter how popular he might be, and he's usually contrasted with an ideal form of democracy. Marxists do this all the time. They'll talk about the ideal form, what Marxism is supposed to be. Then dishonestly, they'll contrast that to how modern governments actually function. And that's dishonest. You can never let your opponent do this. You want to talk about liberal democracy, you have to talk about how it actually functions. Well, the other side to that coin is how dictators function. Now, while I have never accepted the assumptions of liberal democracy, that doesn't mean that I don't believe in representation. I do. The governments that I'm talking about here are quite representative. Liberal democracy has a tendency to promote a handful of millionaires and their peons, because that money and media support and establishment support you need to function for 5 minutes in any kind of campaign, especially in the national level. The military men we're talking about here overwhelmingly are from poor families. And they did well in the military because they had no choice. This was the way out. And today, I'm going to skip over Colombia. I just don't have the time. And I'm going to deal with three places. I'm going to deal with Bolivia, Juan Perón in Argentina, and finally, as you might expect, Pinochet in Chile. And the point of all this is to get their mentality, how they viewed themselves, the context in which they came to power, and what they did with the power that they had. The context is easy because it's always the same. The banana republic, liberal democracy had failed miserably. Oligarchy ruled the country. And a weak state like that cannot take the rich on, since a republic really is just the bodyguard of the wealthy classes. Now in Bolivia, which doesn't get the attention that it should, from 1964 to 1982, you had a tremendous period of instability here. Even military dictators weren't able to put a lid on the violence. Victor Estenssoro, in November of 64, was overthrown by a military junta under General René Barrientos. Now, he was elected in 66, but 3 years later he died in a helicopter crash, which itself led to a coup in September by General Ovando, who then was overthrown in 1970 by General Miranda, who yet again was overthrown a couple days later by General Torres. Oh, and then he was overthrown again in 71 by, I think the better known, Hugo Banzer Suarez. Until Banzer came to power, the military had failed to achieve stability. I want to talk about Ovando and Banzer, Banzer being the best known. Banzer ruled for 7 years, initially from 71 to 74. And he did have the support of Estenssoro's nationalist revolutionary movement. But most of these guys saw themselves as national socialists in one form or another. 1974, being impatient with the schisms in the Nationalist Party, he used military men to replace the civilians, and he suspended civic activities. Under Banzer, the economy grew impressively, as is normally the case under these guys. But the very middle class that they create, and the very university students from the very universities that they founded, eventually undercut his support. It's ironic. You see this in South Korea, where the wealthy children of the middle class created by General Park, from university founded by General Park, try to overthrow him. Well, it has nothing to do with abstract democracy, as nothing ever does. But of course, you're having this new middle class who wants power in line with their newfound money. They turn on the government that created them. 1978, again, Bolivia fell into turmoil. Juan Prieta ruled only for 4 months that year. But becoming president, it marked the beginning of an even more unstable period in Bolivian history, with 9 civilian and military presidents in little over 4 years, from 78 to 82. 1982 saw the return of an elected government with Guido Vildoso as president, and as often the case with the Banana Republic, economic growth grinds to a halt. Anyway, going back to Ovando. Starting in 1964, René Barrientos and General Alfredo Ovando declared themselves co-presidents. But there was a large crowd that gathered in front of the presidential palace, and they were shouting their preference for the more charismatic Barrientos. Ovando allowed him to assume the formal title, but he remained commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Now, I suppose this is direct democracy in action, but that's what happened on November 4th, 1964. Now, Barrientos is a good case study because he ruled both as a military man and as an elected politician, and the difference is night and day. So you have a real scientific way of understanding how they function, because you have the same man functioning as a democratically elected politician and as a military dictator. It's like there are two different men. Well, he insisted that his assumption of power was not a move against the Nationalist Party, and he promised to restore the Bolivian National Revolution to its true path. The instability, of course, had misguided it. His government continued the policies of Estenssoro. And of course, being an elected man, Estenssoro had made his deal with the IMF. Of course, what created their so-called stabilization plan. Elected governments do this because this is how they get quick money. But if a military man does this, he undercuts the whole purpose of having a military government. Military governments seek independence from these bodies, not guidance from them. Only the military has the power to do this. It is the very foundation of their legitimacy. The economy improved under the non-elected Barrientos regime, and it grew almost 7% per year. That was never to be seen again in Bolivia's history. The rise in tin prices was one of their big exports. Resulted in the growth of the state-owned mining corporation. And then medium-sized mines were being founded and mined, but they remained in private hands. Barrientos did encourage the private sector and foreign investment, and he gave the Gulf Oil Company permission to export petroleum and natural gas from Bolivia. 1966, he did win election as president under the party, the Popular Christian Movement. The MPC, which was its Spanish initials, wasn't very successful. He won the election with a coalition of more or less conservative politicians, and he tried to build support in the countryside, and he created in 1964 the Military Peasant Pact. Remember, between 64 and 66, it's a military government. 66 is when he was elected. So in 64, he created the Military Peasant Pact that the local militias, we talked about the Ronda militias in Peru, now you have the Campesino militias in the countryside. These are more or less peasant militias. They were generally anti-leftist, but the pact had them subordinate themselves to the army. He tried to tax these groups, which was a really stupid idea, but he did maintain the import substitution of other military governments. Now, I've used that phrase before. I forget sometimes people don't know it. Import substitution is another word for protectionism. Import substitution is actually a very rational policy. It means that if your country can produce something, there's no reason to import it, even if local companies aren't quite as good as foreign companies. Well, of course you're not going to be. It's a developing country. Import substitution is officially illegal from the WTO, IMF, everybody you could think of that way. But it became the stock in trade of military governments. It's one of the reasons that their economies grew, because once you protect the country from American or Japanese competition, local money then pours into these firms. Competition isn't hurt because usually new ones are formed. A new market is created without these very advanced societies being able to undercut you. But when he was elected, of course, he joined with the IMF and took away all the gains labor had achieved. Under the military, of course, the union leaders were able to veto management decisions. You didn't see this in Marxist countries, because in Marxist countries, labor unions are illegal. The military had the power to overthrow the mentality of the oligarchs. One of the ways they did this is to make sure that union leaders had the right to veto management decisions. He then made another stupid decision under IMF pressure to cut the pay of miners, which is always a bad idea, and reduce the workforce, and cut down the bureaucracy in the mining industry by about 10%. Then he destroyed the Bolivian Labor Federation, and the Mine Workers Union, suppressed all strikes, disarmed the miners' militias, and exiled the union leaders. All of this was done under the IMF, only after he became an elected politician. This is not a coincidence. From 64 to 66, it's these very policies that came into existence that were then overthrown after 66. You have the same man as a military leader on the one hand, elected politician on the other, and it's like two different people. So the thesis here is proven just by that alone. It's pretty rare that you could find someone who's actually done both in one lifetime. But of course, he couldn't completely silence labor. Neoliberalism is always going to be unpopular. Neoliberalism is the term neo or new has to do with it following the Bretton Woods Agreement, which eventually created more or less the mentality of the WTO. It's Neo because it's not Adam Smith. You know, it's 20th century. But the Americans didn't want military governments, had always condemned military governments, because military governments had a tendency to nationalize American capital. But when he became an elected politician, it was nothing except natural resources, either controlled by the U.S. or sold to the U.S. under very favorable terms. So then he invited American investment, and local producers were destroyed. The so-called non-discrimination laws. It means that in any developing country, American capital, Japanese capital, French capital, whatever, is treated the exact same way as local capital. So a local car manufacturer has to compete with General Motors, and the government cannot discriminate against GM. So it's a very bad idea. Barrientos, interior minister, Arguedas, had fled to Cuba. And then he fled to Cuba after telling the world that he had been an agent of the CIA and helped negotiate the so-called return to democracy and bringing back the IMF. In Cuba, Arguedas had said that the CIA had created this entire thing, but the CIA had condemned the military government, and as soon as this guy was elected, he did the opposite of what he had done 4 years before. Well, he was killed in a helicopter crash, Barrientos, in April 1969. But the man who really was in control was General Ovando, who was still commander-in-chief. And he took power in September of 69. And he ruled from, well, he was co-president, essentially, from 65 to 66. And then from 69 to 70. And his cabinet, as again, is also very common with military men, included both pro-Barrientos people and anti-Barrientos people. But given what elections had done in the past, it would have created nothing but polarization and violence. His view was revolutionary nationalism. And he outlined in a work the revolutionary mandate of the armed forces, very similar to what we have dealt with in Velasco in Peru. These are firm national socialists. Velasco, Perón, all very similar. Here, Velasco is, you know, I should note that Velasco's book was given to a very young Hugo Chavez, who had visited the country when he was still in the army. And when he took power in Venezuela, he tried to implement some of these things and had the book reprinted. And the simple fact is that the military had to intervene in politics because civilian governments could not and would not stand up to the IMF. The IMF is just a consortium of bankers. They're nothing more than that. They don't reflect any government, and governments have pretty minimal influence on. The policies that they espouse serve them and serve them alone. The army was the only force strong enough to make war against the social injustice that was brought about by economic dependence. Since most of these men come from poor families, that's where their roots were. This has been the sole purpose of military governments. This is where the legitimacy is to be found. And of course, once the military takes over, they nationalize the assets of the Gulf Oil Company. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua wouldn't even do that. Both Ovando in Bolivia and Velasco in Peru nationalized the central bank. Unfortunately for Ovando, the big problem here was that he's starting already behind in the race because the IMF had done such damage. And at one time, Barrientos was a military man. The army was then tainted. It's a very poor, and the media did not help matters. But what Ovando did is nationalize these industries and then plow that money back into public works. Elections mean dependency on big money, especially foreign money. Military doesn't require that kind of support. Now, the claim that you hear, that I hear almost every day, is that the U.S. supported military dictators. It's absolutely absurd at numerous levels. The economic level is just one. But the American elite, the state, deep state, both, they have a very limited ideological vocabulary. These guys are devious. They're not intelligent. Two very, very different things. And so they refer to both Ovando and Velasco as communists. Because in their mind, any anti-capital measures are automatically Marxist, which is typical of the American ignoramus, but this had already seeped into the highest levels of foreign policy decision-making. But there was great enthusiasm over nationalization. But the international market, under pressure from the U.S. and American oil firms, boycotted Bolivian crude oil. There was a disagreement over compensation. And the economy went into a downturn right on the same time anyway, in terms of global markets. Ovando had re-legalized the labor unions. Unfortunately, they did not trust the army anymore. Barrientos had destroyed that capital that they had built up over all those years. There was a massacre of the miners in 1967. Again, an elected government in Catavi. The army had fired on miners who now didn't trust the army whatsoever. It's understandable, but it is erroneous. It was not the army. It was elected leaders following the IMF. That's what created this disaster. People like Ovando, without needing all these infusions of cash and toadying to media power, was more free. Unfortunately, labor, having separated itself from the army, was influenced by Cuban and other foreign forces. And that these forces are always threatened by populism. And Ovando, for his excellent intentions, was quite indecisive. And we can understand why. The right wing and the left wing tired pretty quickly of his vacillating statements. He even came out one time and said that all private property should be abolished, meaning productive capital. But near the last months of his government, he moved to the right again. So he couldn't really get the left support, he couldn't get the right support, because he went back and forth so many times. So it polarized the military. And of course, the army had lost popularity as soon as Barrientos became an elected politician. So populist national socialist opinion went to General Juan Torres. It's always odd, Spanish names, they usually have 1,000 names, and they use the middle one. Like Hugo Banzer, that's not his last name. General Juan Jose Torres Gonzalez. So we call him Juan Torres for some reason. Anyway, that mentality, the National Socialist mentality, supported either Gonzalez or Miranda. And I'm using the term National Socialist in a very clear ideological way that we've talked about with Velasco. The problem with American labels, though, is that they're idiosyncratic. In America, the word conservatives often means libertarian. But in Europe and the rest of the world, conservative usually refers to the throne and altar mentality that, of course, I espouse, and many military men in the Third World espouse. But during the Cold War, conservative became libertarian because there was this alleged fight against communism. Now, of course, that fight is mythical. The Soviet Union was opposed. The U.S. ruling class traded and bailed out the Soviet Union dozens of times and never ever stopped trading with them, including in very strategic areas. But at least ideologically, it became they became libertarians rather than conservatives in the traditionalist sense of the term. Newspapers refer to these guys as reformist, which is a meaningless term. It would be stretched to cover over anything. But every general that I'm dealing with here, and most of them, and actually all of them in Latin America, were socially traditionalist, but believed in firm national independence in the economic realm. This is what makes them national socialists, in a very broad sense of the term. But when Obando was overthrown, there still was no confidence in civic life, there's no confidence in politicians, and now no confidence in the army. So the major labor unions called the strike, and finally, General Torres emerged as kind of a compromise candidate. Because of this problem, again, a lack of decisiveness was the issue. Military men are usually known for very strong moral values that they defend to the death. In Bolivia, it wasn't the case. A lot of it had to do with context. A lot of it had to do with Barrientos being both a military man and an elected politician. So labor's approach to the army was always very, very odd. He behaved more like an elected politician than a military leader, which destroys the whole reason for a military government in the first place. He did, however, nationalize American property. He nationalized the waste processing operation of the Catavi tin mines and the zinc mines. And he ordered the Peace Corps out of the country, which is nothing new because, as everyone knows, we mentioned this already, the man who fled to Cuba said it was a CIA front. So Torres began increasing its cooperation with the Soviet Union in the economic and technical sectors. But, you know, when there's no other option, a right-wing dictator, whatever that might mean, can approach the USSR. But it doesn't mean that he's a communist. I mean, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Hafez al-Assad in Syria were both Soviet clients for decades. But certainly neither one was a communist. But because he didn't have the clear strategy that Velasco and Perón had, Torres soon alienated everybody, just like his predecessor had. Just like Ovando had, I should say. You know, he couldn't organize a socialist party because they confronted him with demands that he could never meet, like giving them half of all cabinet seats that they weren't elected to or didn't deserve. There were, you know, workers and students saw him as a step in the direction of a socialist state. But what they meant by socialism was very much open to interpretation. He created the Popular Assembly, which is sort of an alternative popular government. The representatives of workers and peasants organizations. And he sought to imitate the mentality of Velasco and Perón, we'll talk about here in a minute, in transforming economic life. But the divides amongst these representatives were too great. No consensus was ever achieved, and delegates were resigning because, very much like any other legislature, it was too divided. There is no foundation for what we would call libertarian free trade in Latin America. In Catholic or Orthodox countries, conservative refers to royalist throne and altar sort of thing. Francisco Franco is what we normally refer to when we say conservative. Both capitalism and Marxism were correctly seen as revolutionary doctrines and products of foreign forces anyway. But possibly just to confuse American leftists, Torres cut the defense budget in order to free more money for education. That fact alone suggests that the way people talk about military leaders in Latin America probably has to change. But while he's building this coalition, he's allowing military discipline to go lax. The last weeks of his rule, a manifesto came out from a group of junior officers who questioned his ability. 1971, Colonel Hugo Banzer Suarez, who was commander of the military academy, and Torres had exiled him before, came to power, and he ruled until 1978. He tried to overthrow Torres more than once. He ruled for 6 years, which is the longest continuous presidential term in recent Bolivian history. And stability finally was achieved. Because of the strength of the military government, you saw unprecedented economic growth in the country. You had a coalition of labor unions that supported him. A whole lot of these guys were allowed to return from exile. And they had been, so many of these guys had been enemies, but the military permitted them to work together. And because they were given this power to work together, they did a good job. They knew that going into exile was impossible. They knew that just trying to kill each other was impossible. They were forced to play nice. In the first years of Banzer's presidency, the economy grew tremendously. Exports tripled between 1970 and 1974. The production of cotton from eastern Bolivia tripled from 70 to 75. And his import substitution policy and subsidies is what drove the development of capital in these areas. He was condemned, obviously, by the U.S. and the IMF. The U.S. rejected him entirely as the economy took off and he became more and more popular. Now, what we said the last time, what normally happens here, is that when a National Socialist military dictator, military leader, is successful, they're successful because they actually do what the so-called socialists promised to do but never do. They're stealing their issues, and so they step up the violence. He had to devalue the peso in 1972, and there was a strike which the state had to repress. In 74, prices increased. You know, when the economy is growing very quickly, sometimes more money is printed than necessary. And the violence got bad. And by the way, probably this is because Banzer had not nationalized the bank, which is the cause of this chaos. But when the labor union split, the coalition fell apart. Even there, the armed forces were divided too. Younger versus older. In 1974, General Gary Prado tried a coup and failed. But November 7th, 1974, that failed coup attempt gave Banzer the freedom he needed to cut all ties with local millionaires, local elites. See, when Western writers refer to civil society or civilian influence, that's usually what they mean. They're talking about millionaires, the people who control the media and most productive capital. Colonel Banzer had announced after this the complete reorganization of the Bolivian political system and the creation of a new Bolivia. His economic miracle did peter out, but it was all due to external forces. He nationalized petroleum and the mineral industry. Cotton production fell because world prices were falling and it hurt the government, despite the fact that it had no control over these prices. The stability here was superficial because the military remained divided, not just by ideology, but by personal rivalry as well. Elite opposition went to the labor union. Radical students and, of course, the Church of Rome became the spokesman for the left. And, you know, the fact is that millionaires don't take to being silenced very well. Now, in 1974, there were negotiations with Chile for an outlet to the sea. When this agreement failed to materialize, there was a tremendous loss of support for the government. Banzer was pressured by the U.S. to hold elections, and any continuation of military rule was condemned violently by the United States. So Banzer announced an election for 1980, but labor unrest, hostility, a lot of it fanned by the U.S. and Cuba, forced him to move it up to 78. July 78, another coup from General Prado was carried out because these elections were nullified because of widespread fraud. All groups were suspected. Again, the country's not ready for elections. So, despite the continuation of military rule, the 78 election fraud marked the beginning of a traumatic transition to liberal elite democracy during the following 4 years. American elites see elections as this magic spell that confers legitimacy to winners. That is, if they're suitably liberal. But elections are very complex processes. They require an advanced society capable of properly debating issues at great length without personal vendettas or memories of violence. The U.S. wanted elections to permit the IMF and World Bank to begin dictating terms to the weak government that it would create. A new government, based on a very weak coalition to stay in power, is desperate for funds, and they'll do whatever they can for any cash infusion, including selling the country strategic assets. That's what elections mean to the Western world. But he became a politician himself and was elected president in 2000. But starting in 71, Banzer's rule introduced stability and economic growth that, had it continued, would have led to a first world Bolivia today. They had the oil, they had the minerals, and they had the will. Outside pressure and his inability to nationalize the bank caused the problem. In 2000, Banzer, now a politician, gave a speech to the Andean Presidential Council. He said, power is a double-edged sword. You say, you know, political analysts, they assume that actors in politics only care about seeking greater and greater power. But as power increases, so is the level of blame that they have to take when things go wrong. Banzer called politics a dirty business. And it suggests that political power is not a universal desire. The assumption isn't that politicians seek power. It needs to be that politicians seek power to the maximum level such that no blame could be assigned to them. In other words, they want as much power as possible before responsibility kicks in. So when responsibility grows too great, the desire for power starts to fade. Now, we use the phrase banana republic. It's an offensive phrase, and it's meant. It refers to liberal democratic governments in countries run by oligarchies. Banana republic is meant to be an offensive phrase, and I'm using it as an offensive phrase. Military governments work because they break oligarchies, and they've done it all over the world. Usually when you consider a military dictator, people usually have some caricature in their mind. But the left condemns these guys not because they're national socialists and because they're not leftists and they're anti-communists, but because they steal the thunder from the left that doesn't practice what they preach anyway. Look, any communist that says we're going to grant land to the peasants can't be a communist. Because Marxism rejects all kinds of private ownership, land included. So either the guy's lying, or he's not really a communist. Now, this simple distinction has yet to be grasped by academics or journalists writing over the last 50 years. So under the army's rule, GDP growth was 6-7% a year. Now, someone with greater stability, someone with a greater reputation, is Juan Perón. He was a military government. He was a national socialist. Explicitly so. And from 1946 to 53, Argentina thrived. He had a planned economy, but not in the Soviet sense of the term. Plans for military governments on the right. I mean, General Park in South Korea used them too. It wasn't the violent imposition that in the Soviet system. But there were general guidelines that set goals and channeled investment funds. But that alone, that was enough to raise the anger of the United States. The IMF was a relatively new organization, and Juan Perón had completely rejected them. And it's because he rejected them that country's gross domestic product expanded by over 25%. During his reign. Using roughly half of the $2 billion that previous agencies had committed to finance fixed capital investments, 70% increase in these capital investments were accounted for mostly by industrial growth in the private sector, not government project. But economic success is never without cost, and it's never an end in itself. State subsidized growth in some sectors, but that just meant that there was a wave of imports of capital goods locals were unable to make themselves. Now, from 45 on, during his reign, Argentine exports rose from $700 million to almost $2 billion. At the same time, Perón's policies led to imports that created a trade deficit just a few years later. Again, what few economics professors will tell you is that foreign exports to the third world country are usually a bad thing, because modern experienced wealthy corporations can easily undersell local businesses, destroying them. An increase in imports, especially over many sectors, is an injection of social poison. But that's the nature of free trade ideology. Juan Perón faced something in Argentina that you don't hear about very often. The British owed Argentina a debt of about $650 million, which back then is a big deal. This is because Argentina was a big supplier of agricultural goods during World War II. And the paper was mostly Argentine central bank reserves that were then deposited in the Bank of England. Now, because the money was kept in trust under the treaty, the money wasn't of any real use to Perón, because since the ruling class in Great Britain condemned Perón as anti-democratic, that gave them the excuse they needed to not pay him back. What you see throughout Perón's reign, despite tremendous economic growth, was an increasingly powerful centralized conspiracy against him. Other than supporting this right-wing dictator, of course, they despise him, like they always do. Now, the currency surpluses from the war. Argentina prospered during World War II because of the beef and other agricultural products that Western Europe needed. The currency surpluses came to about $200 million, but they made them convertible to American dollars. Now, Prime Minister Attlee suspended this agreement. Here's the problem. I bring this up because we all know the third world is deeply in debt to major banks in the first world. Here's a situation where third world country is actually a creditor, and the British weren't going to pay. Advanced states don't pay debts to their underlings. Rather than pay money, the British sent 15,000 miles of old British railways, which turned out to be about half the country, instead of actual payment. So this is what first world countries do when they owe money. But the Argentinians today may wonder why they have to pay anyone back, but the British refuse to pay them back. The American agricultural lobby was outraged at Perón's policy. The foreign exchange earnings in the government completely collapsed. So $100 million surplus turned into a $300 million deficit. It was pure manipulation and imperialism. Neoliberalism is predatory, and it's that is exactly what military governments exist to fight. So this should be kept in mind. Third world governments are drowning in debt. So if England can figure a way around paying their debt by manipulating the currency, then why would the third world have to pay today? Little of the debt that the UK owed to developing countries during World War II was ever paid. But it wiped out the country's reserves, and it was meant to do so. Juan Perón was considered a Nazi or something like that. Yeah, they couldn't figure out if he was a Nazi or a communist, which is often the case. And the country's reserves were wiped out. And the country Perón had to clamp down on the outflow of dollars to American banks. So in response, Perón authorized the nationalization of the port of Buenos Aires. What that meant, despite the screams from Washington, was that the Argentine merchant marine went up over 300% in terms of capital and control. They didn't have to pay shipping fees anymore. Then all of a sudden, the democracy issue comes up. The terms of trade were manipulated by American and British banks. So as always, they have to devalue the peso, which led to a decline of imports of capital. So these problems, these so-called third world debts, come from the manipulation of the world markets and currency from the major banks. The goal is to maneuver governments to borrow more and more, leading to total dependency. So Perón, having a huge surplus a short time before, had to borrow $125 million from the Export-Import Bank to cover debts to the very same banks. He had better harvests in 1950, but inflation increased. You had 50% in 1951. And this monetary warfare led to a massive recession. Purchasing power of the average worker in Argentina had declined 20% from its 1948 high, and you saw zero growth. You had 25% growth before. From 48 to 52, you had it, it was flat. This solely comes from predatory policies from the West. But you did now, of course, have a frequency of strikes directed against Perón, even though he had nothing to do with any of it. So he threw the organizers out of the country. Perón was called a fascist in Washington, and he knew they were trying to get rid of him. So in response, Perón called for broader constitutional reform with an elected convention that eliminated the 1853 Constitution. The Constitution, in this case, talked about the nature of National Socialism as such. So he began a massively Hitlerian level of public investment in infrastructure, modernizing the railways, which because the British had sent all kinds of incompatible gauges. He nationalized private airlines, and he used that money to buy 36 new DC-3s and DC-4s and built a brand new international airport. He expanded the electric grid, hydroelectric capacity, promoted the fossil fuel industry, all from national firms. You had a 1,200-mile pipeline. You had a huge explosion of natural gas development in the country, and it became self-sufficient, which for the IMF is almost a curse word. The IMF demanded fair bidding. It's the same thing as the non-discrimination clauses in these treaties. But so-called fair bidding means foreign control. Perón's pipeline, gas pipeline, was the longest in the world at the time. But this is typical for military governments. Private property is not a right, but it's simply something that might be utilitarian for the moment. So YPF, which was a state-owned energy firm, saw an 80% increase. Massive 3.3 million to 4.8 million cubic meters. But even that was the case, the demand for oil grew because the economy is growing so fast. So Perón's response to the IMF was massively successful. He created the military of hell. He built over 4,200 clinics and hospitals. Because it was done by the state, the IMF condemned it. They wanted foreign firms to be able to compete with the sector for profit. He built over 8,000 schools. And the only way that these public investments could be done without the massive profits going outside the country was because he was a military man and he had that power to keep the IMF and the local elite at bay. $650,000 new homes were built. He created the National Mortgage Bank, which took mortgages outside of private hands. We know what happened in this country in 2008. And it kept pace with the U.S. at the time. Argentina had one of the highest rates of residential home construction in the world. Construction firms in the U.S. hysterically demanded sanctions against the communist and or fascist Perón, who shut them out of the development of this country. Social Security was made universal. Education was made free for everybody. Working students were given one paid week before every major examination. Vast low-income housing projects were created. Paid vacations, having been introduced by Hitler's Germany in 1930, became standard, or the 1930s became standard. All workers, regardless of their status, were guaranteed free medical care and half their vacation expense. So when they went on vacation, the state paid half. Or they split it with the if it was a private owner. Expectant mothers received 3 paid months prior to and after giving birth. Workers' recreation centers were constructed throughout the country. Now, most of these were copied from Hitler's initiatives from 34 to 39, but they were very successful. Perón was a national socialist in the best sense of the term. His public speeches show what his mentality was. We call it corporatist nationalism, in that he created the syndicalist form of rule. He blurred the distinction, of course, between private and public. This exact approach is what brought South Korea from third world to first world in about 15 years under General Chung Hee Park. The labor unions had very little to say at this time. But of course, like most military governments, they agreed to not strike in exchange for a strong voice in economic planning. But it's not that power is what they strike for. To have a voice in planning is more power than any labor union had anywhere else, certainly in the communist world. So why would you strike if you had this power, since that kind of power is what striking is all about? In other words, he gave them their demands before they were made. He was neutral, protectionist in his foreign policy. And he saw himself, I mean, there's still a Perón party today. Now, let me ask you this. What I just explained here, does that match up to the typical military dictator that you'll hear about in school? Now, would a democratic legislature, dependent on foreign cash for the very existence, have done the same as Perón? What would Argentina look like if the military had not taken over? Why are all these states, now long in the grip of the IMF, still struggling with poverty when these military governments had begun the slow conquest of these issues back in the 1960s or before? Could a democratically elected government at the time in a third world country do any of this? No. No. All right, I'm at 52 minutes. And we'll see if I can get Pinochet in before my hour is up. I published a paper on him some time ago. Let me give you the Reader's Digest version here. September 11th, 1973, military overthrew the Allende government. Remember, there was tremendous violence in the country on the brink of civil war. And it's important to remember that he was asked to do this. I want to quote from a journal called Liberty from 1999, written by John Mukobin and Karen Whale. Let me quote this, and this actually summarizes what happened in Chile. Chile's struggle against the communists was a just conflict. The revolution in Chile was an act of self-defense against legal looters and armed bandits. As inevitable in any war, errors were made, innocent lives lost. But despite the mistakes, the revolution left a positive legacy. Chile has a free and prosperous economy and a stable republican institution. This is the context in which the British arrest of General Pinochet, the leader of this revolution, must be judged. When Pinochet took over, Chile was experiencing a rapid decay in the quality of life. Salvador Allende had been elected president in a three-way election where he won 36.3%, decided by the legislature. He became essentially a Castro. The reports of Allende killing hundreds or at least dozens of people in the countryside as soon as he took over. There was 1,000% inflation during his 1,000 days of rule. Food production ground to a halt. Now, if the U.S. was supporting Pinochet, why didn't the system bother to mention Allende's killings? Why didn't the government write papers and books explaining his success? Why didn't the State Department and the CIA bring Chilean writers who backed Pinochet to the U.S.? Why was he barred from the U.S. in the 1970s? But Soviet technicians were invited to study at MIT. The authors continue. Hector Hevia, a Chilean professor who lived through those chaotic times, says you had to wait in line for hours to get a piece of meat you probably couldn't even eat anyway. By July 73, Allende had centralized control of nearly everything, including replacing the top two men in every firm with a bureaucrat loyal to him. Allende was destroying people's lives, and Chileans had a right to defend themselves. There were massive demonstrations calling for Allende's resignation. On August 22, 1973, the Chilean Chamber of Deputies passed a resolution of censure against Allende. Congressional deputies condemned him and his government for violating the Constitution and the law in order to institute a totalitarian system opposed to the representative system of government that the Constitution establishes. And they called upon the military to intervene. According to the report of the Redding Commission, of later the Alvin government that elected came later, there were 1,173 deaths, including military men, both during the revolution and its aftermath, from September to December 1973. The Redding Commission reported a total of 2,033 deaths perpetrated by the military during their 17 years of rule, and 265 deaths of military personnel, civilians killed by terrorists, and deaths due to general political violence. The deaths are undercounted on both sides. The number of people who disappeared are included in the total. And let me add here, this means that his so-called reign of terror amounted to about 100 executions a year. Anyway, they continue. The majority, 63% of those killed were members of the Marxist movement. This is the movement of the revolutionary left, which is entirely a terrorist group. The Manuel Rodriguez Front, which is entirely terrorist. The Socialist and Communist parties, both of which had armed contingents, and smaller, violent Marxist parties, Soto Sierra, president of the group of those disappeared in Chile, herself a communist, stated that the percentage of people killed who were affiliated with Marxist parties was actually much higher, since relatives often feared to publicly reveal the political affiliations of those who were dead. Now keep in mind what Mao had done in China here. This was going on as these events are taking place. But Pinochet is arrested at the request of a Spanish court, and they seek to prosecute him for the so-called offenses. Genocide, no less. 100 executions a year. Most people were absolutely outraged in Chile, at least on nationalist ground, when he was arrested. Polls put the popular support in Chile for Pinochet at over 75%. The Terra University of Radoval says that about 40% of Chileans would firmly stand behind Pinochet, and there are about maybe another 40% who would support his return to Chile. The vast majority want Pinochet freed. Of course, this is several years ago after he was arrested by the British government. There are many pro-Pinochet demonstrations in front of the British and Spanish embassies. The boulevard in front of the Spanish embassy is at times sealed off, along with the British ambassador's residence, continually barricaded. To charge Pinochet with murder would be as unjust as charging Patrick Henry or Thomas Jefferson with murdering redcoats or accidentally shooting a neighbor while trying to kill a redcoat. All these revolutionary acts are self-defense. Their cause is just. The media in the U.S. has distorted facts regarding Pinochet. He stands accused of murder. And that's the beginning and end of the story, as far as most journalists are concerned. But CNN, international news media, rarely reveal details of the terrorist activities of the communists that Pinochet was fighting. Because of their mostly leftist bias, media do not sympathize with Pinochet or his revolution against the armed socialists who pushed his country to the brink of civil war. They portray him as a senseless and brutal dictator, but they ignore the circumstances in which Pinochet assumed power. Of course, the point of all of this is to prevent a bloody, protracted civil war. It was a war. It was a civil war, however brief it might have been. Now, continuing here, Pinochet carried out an economic and political revolution that successively devolved power away from the state. After, he voluntarily stepped down from power. In doing so, his successors agreed to give him immunity from prosecution. This seems like a reasonable arrangement. The revolution was over peace, prosperity, and a stable republic, which stood in the way of chaos, poverty, and dictatorship. Pinochet was no tyrant. Tyrants don't usher in more freedom. They don't step down voluntarily. But Pinochet did both. This is the nature of what happened at the time. Pinochet has done nothing wrong. Pinochet was a successful ruler who brought peace to that country for the first time in a very long time. But it's very hard to find real economic statistics for the era. You have certain liberal Marxist groups who try to say it was only 1% growth every year, which is not true. But the World Bank says something very different. The World Bank, measuring this in dollars, claims the Chilean economy increased by about 8% every year on average. And this was at a time of financial meltdown throughout Latin America. Look, the Pinochet's coup against Allende was welcomed by many people. The Christian Democratic Party supported the coup. Patricio Aylwin, who had become Chile's first democratically elected president after Pinochet's resignation, he thanked the army for saving Chile's democracy. But there's no doubt that Chile's economy began reviving almost immediately. Within a few years, it overtook all the economies of South America. Yeah, people were calling it locally the Switzerland of Latin America. Planless efficiency, relative wealth. So the West is being flooded by communist propaganda, describing Chile as hell. Pinochet was probably enjoying the highest approval rating of the whole of Latin America. I'm quoting Piero Sgroffi here. The only dictator in modern history who let people vote against him. He lost his referendum by a very narrow margin. Two or three years earlier, he would have won it easily. Proof is that Allende's disciples have lost all elections since the return to democracy. Over and over again, Chileans have voted to keep the leftists out of the government. So that, in a very, very brief way. Pinochet's so-called brutality saved lives. The trade volume rose from $3 billion to $16 billion, from 85 to 95. So his so-called brutality left Chile with the lowest infant mortality rates in Latin America, with a score of 8 per 1,000 live births. The rest of the continent had 27. 8 per 1,000 in Chile, the U.S. had about 7 per 1,000. England about 6. And that's around, 27 is where Chile stood at the time of Allende. He saved countless lives. The country had a literacy rate of 96%. And when he left office in 1990, Chile went into a tailspin. Catastrophic recession. Inflation was brought under control only by the military. Anyway, I've gone over my time here. I didn't want to do a part 3, so I'm making this a part 2. The U.S. government never backed a military government, not Pinochet, not anybody. The third world status of Latin America exists because the military wasn't permitted to function. Wherever you go, thanks to the IMF and the World Bank, local companies in Latin America have been crushed by foreign competition. You see what Hitler did in Germany, General Park did in South Korea, taking a third world country and making it a first world country almost overnight. Reading the reports from the CIA and the NSA in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the U.S. condemned military governments wherever they developed. They condemned them over and over again. What they wanted more than anything else was weak banana republics that would make it easy for American capital to invest with no problem. They had no difficulty with Marxist governments, none whatsoever. Because Marxist governments were not going to nationalize American property like the military governments had. These military men, and Pinochet was a bit different. He was more of a libertarian than these other guys. But still, the anti-communist message was very clear. The communists were not going to give land to peasants because that's not communism. They rejected all forms of labor participation in politics and banned labor unions. That's the Marxist legacy, not on paper, but in reality. The assumptions of liberal democracy are absurd. It is the mentality of the oligarchy. Military government or a monarchy is the opposite. It's dedicated to the common good, especially when these guys come from poverty, as most of these military guys did. Military government, based on National Socialism, works all the time. These would be first world countries if they were permitted to continue. But the U.S. did everything it could to destroy them consistently. And it's all the same. They fought against the hollowing out of their countries from the capitalists abroad. And whatever success that they had was all undone when the IMF supported these banana republics. And when in places like Argentina and Peru, when their militaries were forced out of power, they were on the verge of first world status. Today, in the name of democracy and human rights, Latin America remains in poverty, crime, and drowning in drugs. Liberal democratic capitalism is the ideology of the imperial states. They're meaningless buzzwords, but unfortunately have real-world consequences for those in the third world who suffer under them. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This is the end of part two. I appreciate Sven for all the work he does. I appreciate all of my opponents as well as all my friends. Remember, you have to have opponents. They keep you honest. I appreciate all of you very much. Thank you, guys. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.